Psychology in Seattle.
So, Berto, I thought we would just do some random stuff today. What do you say?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist, and I'm also a professor at Antioch University. Who are you, Beto?
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I teach courses on untying knots.
So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
People want us to talk about it.
Oh my God, I just watched it last night.
Rating out of 10.
Oh, I'll give it a 9.5.
Wow.
At least a 9.
Okay.
Certainly at least a 9.
At first, I gave it a 9, and then I watched it a second time. I was like, yeah, solid movie, and I gave it an 8.
Okay.
But my 8 is a rare rating.
Sure, I know. You give there's movies you love that you gave a 6.
Right, or a 7. Yeah. I mean, because by definition, you know, numeric-wise, yeah. Like 5 means, you know, okay. And 6 means it's better than a lot of movies, you know?
I'll have to watch it again, but you're going to think this may be sacrilege, but it's my new second favorite Tarantino movie.
Well, let's go into that. So, okay. what are your ratings for all of the Tarantino's movies?
So, Pulp Fiction for me is 10.
Okay.
That's just a 10.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
My previous favorite was actually Django.
Yeah.
Django. I gave that at like a 9 at least. I just thought it was so poignant, so good, everything. After that, it might be Reservoir.
Yeah.
And then maybe Inglourious. What was the other one that he did recently?
Hateful Eight.
Hateful Eight. Yeah,
Inglourious
that one
Bastards.
Was there. Yeah. So probably Hateful Eight after Inglourious Bastards.
So,
I know you love Jackie Brown, and so you might be wondering, where the hell is Jackie Brown?
Well, I need
to rewatch that one, but...
Yeah, so, I mean, I just feel like Jackie Brown was underrated. I'm not saying it's like my favorite. So for me, having watched many times, I've watched Reservoir Dogs, Django Unchained, and Hateful Eight many times.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched scenes from it many times. There's just so many just awesome nuggets. I recently rewatched Reservoir Dogs all the way through from beginning to end and was just blown away. It's like,
so
this is such like... No one is making movies like this.
Yeah.
And at the time, in 1992, it was just unheard of.
Yeah.
The next class are having watched many scenes many times and enjoyed a lot and better than like 99.9% of the other movies out there. Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
Kill Bill and Death Proof, I watched once. They were great.
Interesting.
They were interesting. Yeah. Probably better than 75% of the movies that are made in any given year. But I've never returned back and don't care to.
Agree.
Once Upon a Time, I guess I would put in the top category there too. If I was to rank everything, I got to put Reservoir Dogs. I'm sort of a purist. Like, you know, Star Wars 4 is like my favorite. I used to think Empire was, but while you were watching all of them, I was like, Star Wars 4 is just a solid movie.
So flawless.
Bottle Rocket is one of my favorite Wes Anderson movies.
So you usually give it to that OG.
the first R.E.M. album, Murmur, is one of my favorite albums of all time.
Well, I usually tend to go for the second one.
So, and I was there. I saw Reservoir Dogs when it came out.
Wow.
You know, so when Pulp Fiction came out, I was like, oh, he made another one.
Right, which I definitely was not. In fact...
So if I saw Pulp Fiction, that was my first Tarantino movie, you know. It's sort of like I like Gish better than I like Siamese Dream. Anyway, so where would I put it? I don't know. It's hard to know now because it's still kind of...
Fresh.
Yeah, fresh. Okay, so great story. Okay, let's talk about the Manson family because, you know, people are emailing us and say, talk about this movie, talk about the Mansons. What do you think about the depiction of the Manson family?
I thought it was awesome. I mean... The actual thing is horrible and terrible. I'm saying the depiction was so good. Just the first of all, he did such a good job with the time, like just depicting that time. It's before my time, but I was alive at a time where I could sense where things had come from in the last 10 or 20 years. So it felt so good, so real. And then that whole Hollywood time, it felt like he depicted it so well. And then the kids, the hippies, hitchhiking in the street and like kind of this wild abandon. And then when Brad Pitt goes to the commune and they're all so perfectly brainwashed. It was, oh, so good. Also from what I've read and or watched as far as documentaries of them. Granted, they didn't show Manson or a lot of the videos they made and a lot of things. But other than that, man, there was a lot of bells being rung as I was watching that of like, yeah, that seems believable. That seems realistic. And creepy, like very creepy.
Yeah.
You know, like just that whole scene where he's asking about the owner of the ranch and they're like, I wouldn't recommend going up, you know, like on, and all those interactions are great. And of course, you know that, well, he's this badass. So, but even with all that, you're still getting the sense of dread. And then knowing what happened that in real life with the murders, just that whole scene leading up to that was so creepy and foreshadowy and just dreadful. It was dreadful.
Yeah. I went and saw it twice. And the second time I went with Drain and one of his friends, and on the way into the movie theater, I asked Drain's friend, I was like, so do you know much about the Manson murders? And he's like, well, kinda. And I was like, well, let me give you kind of a real quick rundown so that you can enjoy this movie a little
better. Because I want you to know what the hell's happening.
Right. And so I gave him a quick rundown. And then right after the movie, he was like, thank you so much for telling me, because I would have had no idea.
Yeah, that's what they fair.
I wouldn't have known that was Charlie Manson. Because they don't focus on that. I wouldn't have known.
He's only in one scene.
Barely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I saw it, I was like, oh, that must be, oh, yeah, it's totally Charles Manson right there. Plus, I knew, I've delved into that story so much that I knew he was in, you know, he knew that house and blah, blah, and the Manson family, you know, and all the details about that. The guy that I went with, he was like, I wouldn't have known who those people were. I wouldn't have known Sharon Tate. I didn't know who she was. Like if you mentioned Sharon Tate, I would have thought, is that a fictional character? You know, yeah. Is the Leo character, you know, because the Leo character is fictional. The Brad Pitt's character is fictional. So yeah, the Sharon Tate.
But many of the other ones are.
They must all be fictional.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so I wonder about some people who don't know enough about the Manson family, because you have to know some pretty detailed things to enjoy the
irony,
the historical the historical depiction of trying, like the Manson family girls wandering around downtown.
Well, actually, that's a great point. I also wonder if someone that doesn't know any of this would sit there going like, what kind of cult like that? That would be so unrealistic. No one would go live on a ranch with like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I thought it was well depicted. It's, you know, it's hard to depict something like this because it's so foreign to our understandings today.
Right.
It's such a weird part of our history. You know, we don't really have anything that's similar to that. Like when we watch this movie, it's like, well, we know what actors are because we have actors today. Stuntmen, we can imagine what that's like. We can imagine what an agent is like in Hollywood. Yeah. You know, all these things are taking drugs, having a dog. There's all these very relatable things.
So even if you hadn't been aware of those times and those kind of versions of them, you know the idea.
Right, because you've lived it or you've seen it depicted. But the late 60s, early 70s America and in Hollywood was so weird and unique that I thought that Tarantino depicted it well, especially if you knew the history a little bit. Like the anti-cop sentiment, I guess we can kind of relate to that today because that reeled back in the 80s and 90s and has reemerged, right? But it was really bad in the late 60s, early 70s. The police officers were much more brutal than they are today. There were no, you know, badge cams or cell phones to stop them from doing things. They were mostly white people, the cops. So the feeling was the battle, the war between certain groups of people, including white people, and the police force was real. The anti-establishment nature of teenagers at the time was off the charts. And just anti-adult in general.
You weren't cool if you weren't that.
Well, not only that, but the adult world was so illogical. And teenagers were not paid attention to.
Right.
Many a times they weren't even allowed to vote, you know, the mm-hmm. voting age, blah, blah. And so this this feeling of the baby boomers and how many of them there were and how they were starting to get power and education and money and free time and the cultural force of the music and the, you know, folk music movement and everything, and how they felt empowered, but there was no accommodation from any of the adults or the right. establishment.
And so, not to mention that, like, when it came to females, for example,
right.
females were so unpowerful in society.
Right.
So you could actually see that even though the Manson cult was completely patriarchal, at the same time, you could imagine how it would offer more power
right.
and potential illusion of success in existence for these females.
Agency, yeah. you know, like a choice to do yeah. something. You know, like, I get to live the life I want to live. I get yeah. to have sex when I want to have sex. I get to, you know, not necessarily have to just sit at home and be a baby-making machine.
That's right. The
free love of the time, the drugs, the guru culture at the time is something that yeah. I think you pick up in this movie. The fact that at the time people thought it was the end of the world, the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. they did not know that was going to end. The nuclear Holocaust was a very,
yeah.
very real thing. The Cuban Missile Crisis was in the early 60s. That was yeah. a very real thing. People, you know, unless you really understand history or lived during the time, it was an apocalyptic time. It wasn't yeah. like Flower Child and the Beatles and nice things. You know, it was an intense time. And
right.
we had the most domestic terrorism in the early 70s we've ever had in history. Like hundreds of times more deaths, domestic terrorism then yeah. than today. The difference is today we have Twitter. Back then, you might not even hear about many of the imagine yeah. a domestic terrorist event like a bombing, like a mail, which is what a lot of them did. They would mail bombs like the Unabomber. Imagine today a professor gets or someone who works for NASA or someone, a government official or a mayor, gets a bomb, blows up, and his hand is blown off. Imagine how fast of a story that would be. Back right. then, it was like you might not hear about that ever because you just yeah. didn't happen to flip totally. By that you know, newspaper story. And so there was just a lot of really horrible things happening at the time. And because there was this big divide between the adults and some of these kids, there was no guidance from the adults because the adults didn't have any way of knowing how to guide. So it's just complete disconnect between the generations. The thing that I'll say is so me and Stacy, we saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And then the next day, I saw Charlie Says, which is a movie about the Manson family. It's probably the best movie about the Manson family I've ever seen.
It's out right now?
It came out a year ago or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where did you see it? On Netflix or something?
I think so.
Okay.
And so Charlie Says, so if you want to know about if you want to know about Manson family, you want to see that it essentially it follows. So Gilly from Game of Thrones
uh-huh.
Is the main character, and she enters the Manson family.
Oh, okay.
And so we see her, and she's involved in the second murders of the second night. And there's two timelines. There's her entering the cult, and then the second timeline is when she's in prison and she's basically being deprogrammed.
I see.
By this social worker. And it, I think, is the best movie about Manson, because if you really want to understand, in the similar way that the best thing you could ever watch about O.J. Simpson is, I think it's called Once Upon a Time in America or something. What's it called? O.J. Simpson, it's a documentary about
him.
The best thing you want to see about Larry Nassar is the HBO documentary, because it's not the tagline like Larry Nassar evil or O.J. Simpson evil or Charlie Manson evil. What you see in Charlie Says is that it was a cult, but it had benefits. You know, people came to it for a reason. 99% of the time, it was a good place. And although you might look at it and think it looks weird, the camaraderie, the sisterhood that these women had, the love that they had for each other, the support they gave each other, the fun they had, the way that their life was like a utopia in some ways. They lived off the land. They dumpster dove. They didn't consume. They didn't hurt anybody.
Until they did.
But primarily because Manson was, in my estimation, what happened was drugs could have affected him, I think, in some level. But I also think his narcissism, his narcissistic supply, every time he – so when you're a narcissist, you believe erroneously that if you have your narcissistic supply met, you will feel finally okay. So you're Charlie Manson. You're like, well, if I can get one person to hang out with me and look up to me, then I'll feel okay.
Yeah.
Because people like this grew up in very attachment-injured environments growing up, and so they resort to this notion, false notion, that if they're the center of the universe and people are worshiping them, then they'll have attachment security. And they will for a very brief amount of time, but not much. Anyway, so if I get one person to worship me, if I get 10 people to worship me, if I get 10 people to have sex, you know, if I can manipulate them, then I'll know I'm a good enough person because if I can get 10 people to believe every word I say, and then I get that and it no longer, you know, it works for a week, but then after, okay, now I need to be a rock star. And this was the turning point for Manson and the family was, you know, he had the Beach Boys in his back pocket, or at least one of them. The Beach Boys actually recorded one of his songs and he was on his way up. And if he had actually become a rock star, like a Jim Croce, he was sort of a Jim Croce sort of character. Yeah. And had a string of, you know, 5 hits over the next 10 years and toured. And he would have just been one of those asshole musicians.
Ted Nugent style.
Yeah, he would be a famous guy and you'd hear these stories about how he was
a jerk.
Yeah, a jerk at times. Because he would be getting that narcissistic supply.
Might have still gone a little, like, psychotic, but...
Well, psychotic meaning delusional, but no.
Or delusional, yeah.
He wasn't delusional. He was never delusional.
Well, I just mean like all those videos of him kind of saying ridiculously.
But I think he's trying to get attention. And or he believes because he was getting them.
Well, right. I guess what I mean is you might have still seen those kinds of videos, but not connected to him having orchestrated murders.
Yeah.
More like that dude. Kanye. Like something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Kanye is actually a really good example.
Yeah.
So, in someone who's injured who needs to get that attention, and when they don't get it, they crumble very quickly. It's not that they're just like, oh, bummer, I'm not getting attention. It's like the floor drops out from underneath them and they feel like they're nothing. They're empty. They're nobody. And so Manson, if he had been signed and blah, 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 then that's the route. But he wasn't. He was summarily rejected by, and they depict this in Charlie Says pretty well, and that's when things start to take a turn. He was controlling before, and he would occasionally lash out at people. But this is when he's like, okay, well, what can I do? Well, what I can do is I can start the race war, and I will be the one to start the race war.
Right.
And I think he legitimately believed this. I think he legitimately thought, if I can get this gaggle of 15, 20 people to do this one thing, we can be the spark that lights the fire.
Right.
Because again, to us now, we're like, what? But at the time, there was massive amounts of tensions between young people and old, between black people and white, between people who hated the cops and the cops, between rich and poor, between government and non-government. There was like there were many fires that were happening. And there were many organizations, domestic terrorism, which you could argue Manson was, that believed the same thing, that they were going to be the chevron that starts the race war.
Right.
That was going to be like the black man standing up and carving out his own state or his own country or his own whatever.
That was like the ideal, but he didn't really have an organized plan around
it. Right. He was not a smart dude.
Right.
You know, a smarter person would be like, one, sometimes it takes longer to be famous. He just wasn't a very commonsensical person and kind of impulsive at the same time. And I think he thought, well, this will satisfy my narcissistic need. And then it landed him in jail, of course.
Yeah.
Once upon a time in Hollywood, I thought from the perspective we see it, depicted it pretty well in that, you know, the Brad Pitt character befriends one of these girls and she's very sexually promiscuous.
You get the sense she's like 17 or 16 or something.
Or 15 or
something. Yeah.
And she is of the streets. She hates cops. And then when Brad Pitt proves himself to – he's like, I'm not – you know, this is kind of bullshit. I think all this, whatever is happening here is bullshit. I'm not going to play your game. Then she turns on him.
Right.
Because that means, you know, she's in a cult and she's.
You're the blind one.
Yeah. And they depict that. So seeing those two movies, like tonight, you should watch Charlie Says.
Okay.
Because seeing them back to back, because it's shot at, it's all shot at, both movies are shot on location where the Manson family was.
Oh.
Like,
okay.
I don't know if the ranch still exists, but it almost looks like
shot it at the same place.
But okay. It looks like they shot the same set.
Wow, okay.
So I'm guessing they just left it or something, the ranch.
That's crazy.
Some people don't like the ending. Have you heard that?
Of Once Upon a Time?
Yeah.
From what perspective? I haven't heard that.
Oh, I guess you haven't been talking. So
no.
Many people.
And you know why I haven't been talking, right? Because until I watch something, yeah.
So many people. So we're going to spoil.
Spoiler alert.
Quentin Tarantino plays with the Manson family story at the very end.
Yeah.
Instead of – so basically in the real story, they march up to the house of Sharon Tate. They kill Sharon Tate and
– with her unborn child.
With her unborn child and her three house friends, including the guy played by Herschel.
Yeah.
What's his friend? Emil. And
Emil Hirsch.
Hirsch. And because Leo DiCaprio is annoyed with this loud car, he comes out, yells at them, and then they leave. They come back. They're like, we're going to kill those people.
Yeah.
Like, screw Sharon Tate. We're going to kill these people.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, you know. And they don't realize that he's not alone in the house, and there's a vicious dog and
even more vicious bodyguard, essentially.
Yeah. And a flamethrower.
And a flamethrower, yeah.
And so they all die. Sharon Tate lives.
By the way, I was laughing my ass off during those scenes.
Yeah, me too. And the audience. So I saw it packed audiences like opening week. The whole – so what people are saying about the last scene is that it – they love the movie. You know, they're like, oh. Yeah. What they're saying is like it's not a very Tarantino-like movie. You know, it's like, you know, there's not a lot of gore. There's not a lot of misogyny. You know, it's like a beautiful movie. And then at the end, he ruins it by making it a Tarantino movie. What do you think about that, Berto?
That is the most ridiculous thing. First of all, I guess I could see. So a Tarantino movie is not a Tarantino movie because of violence and gore. It's the dialogue. Now, it happens to be, in a lot of his movies, violence and gore. But, you know.
But a movie like Reservoir Dogs, for example, there's not a lot of violence and gore.
No.
It's like nine. It's packed to the hill with dialogue.
Now, what there is, and this one has it in spades, is implied threat. And this has implied threat from the very beginning, especially if you know the story. I guess if you don't know the story, the Manson story, maybe you don't catch on to that. But for anyone that knows the story, man, so ominous, right? Because you're like, oh, God, there they are. Oh, they're trying to hitch a ride. Oh, God. And then you see Sharon Tate and you know what's coming and it's just so horrible. So anyways, that's there in a brilliant fashion. In a way, that tension he builds at the beginning of Inglourious Basterds stretched out for most of the movie. And then, of course, yes. So Tarantino is a visual guy and he loves his revenge fantasies. What of his movies doesn't have some revenge porn in it?
Django Unchained.
Yeah.
Inglourious Basterds.
Absolutely. Pulp Fiction has a whole revenge sequence in it.
Right.
You know, so I'd say it's as Tarantino as it gets. I thought the violent moments were glorious. It was so good. And this is the part where I'm like, maybe I'm part psychopath because when I see the bad guys getting it in a movie, I'm like, yes, you know?
Yeah.
So
I will say... I enjoyed it, but thinking back when the girl is in the pool and she's like flailing her arms,
yeah,
it's a little goofy.
It is.
I mean, really goofy and a little distracting.
Like, plus, she would have been like go underwater.
Right.
Yeah, you know, sure.
Yeah, it, like that. Although I was screaming when Leo get it was funny because like you see Leo go away and you're like, okay, he's getting away. But then you just see his foot because I watched it. I paid attention the second time they edit it. So you just see his foot through some lawn furniture and you see the bottom of of the flamethrower and and you think, oh my God, does he have it?
Yeah.
And then
Now I thought, but Quentin has goofy moments in his movies. That's also part of it, you know.
Django Unchained for sure, Hateful Eight for sure, Reservoir Dogs not so much.
But like Pulp Fiction, I mean, bring out the gimp and like,
but not like,
and the uncomfortable watch up my ass. He's got goofiness.
So uncomfortable watch up my ass, definitely. But still, anyway, tonally, that would be just the one little.
And I mean,
I
like
make.
Kill Bill, like it's full of goofy.
Right. Yeah. But I definitely like the ending. And the thing is, that's not the real ending.
Right.
The real ending is, I mean, it's not the real ending of the movie.
No.
The real ending is when Leo is walking around, you know, seeing his friend go off and go like, what does Brad Pitt say? Something like, I'm one with the universe, or what was he?
He said, well, because he's like, well, look, I'm not dying today, so don't worry about that.
But he's still tripping. And
right.
He says some sort of trip phrase like, whoa, here we go.
No.
Away we go.
Is that a Rick and Morty reference, or is Rick and Morty a reference to something that they're referencing?
Oh, I don't know.
Because that's what Rick says. That's one of his catchphrases.
So,
and away we go.
So then Leo, whom you're pulling for the whole movie, who is a very relatable character, imposter syndrome, beats himself up, drinks too much.
By the way, oh my God, what a performance.
Yeah.
I love Leo. I would lick ice cream off of Leo.
Yeah. The whole Leo character, his acting is so good that it just sort of passes by you without you really even noticing.
Yeah.
Because I think like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a lot of people focus on the Manson stuff, but that's really very small.
Yeah. Except for there is this beautiful, and I thought it was beautiful. He was giving a gift to the lives that could have been in general.
Right.
And with Sharon Tate especially, he did such a beautiful, like, I don't know if you know the backstory that the sister was really concerned about this movie. Or not sister, what would have been the relationship? I forget. Someone from the Tate family was really, must be the daughter of
Could be sister.
But the point is that when he explained to her what he was trying to do, she was like, okay, I get it. And she was interviewed and she was like, no, after talking to him, because it's this beautiful, like what her life could have been.
Yeah.
And the beautiful moments of her looking at herself and showing her talent that she had.
Right.
And there were no negative portrayals of her. Like she was portrayed as this like super happy, super welcoming person, beautiful in the prime of her life. And I was expecting a little bit like, well, what's the dark side? There was no dark side. She was just great. And then Leo, of course, completes his arc and you just know, oh, he's going to get a Polanski movie. Oh, yay.
Yeah.
And maybe influence Polanski not to do bad things with kids. Oh, who knows?
Right. Like Clint Eastwood, for example.
Right.
He could have had a similar fate as the Leo character in that he was typecast and then he went to do spaghetti westerns. And then at some point, Clint Eastwood somehow got a break to it would have been much later because in the 70s he was doing like Any Which Way But Loose and all those and the Dirty Harry movies. But at some point he like graduated to more interesting roles and probably
and
more fulfilling
director.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I thought the same thing. It was just I didn't know where it was headed, and I wasn't really thinking. Did you know where it was headed?
Well, no. I had a couple of thoughts because one, I was really sad that I found out ahead of time that it involved the Manson family. I was really sad because I would have loved that moment in the movie where I'm like, "Oh my God, is this what I think it right?" That, but fine. But I knew what I did have a feeling is because I know Tarantino and I know he loves his revenge stuff and I kind of got the sense that Brad Pitt was like this badass. So I'm like, oh I think I kind of sensed what was going to happen there.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah.
I thought
it was going to be different. I thought they were going to come to Sharon Tate's. They were going to go in. I even thought, you know what? At one point I thought Brad Pitt was going to come back from the walk with the dog and Leonardo was going to be dead, and then they were either in the middle of or had just killed the other ones, and then he was going to go back to the ranch and lay waste.
Oh, like a Django and Chain.
Yeah, I thought that was going to happen. Or even that the two of them, like maybe he wasn't full, like they were going to go. And finally, I kind of thought he was going to do like a real life cowboy revenge at the ranch, you know.
Interesting. Yeah, I liked it a lot. And again, forget about the ending. The first 95% of the movie is just these beautiful, interesting depictions of a character who's trying, and he has a craft, and he's interacting with other people. There's not a lot of cheap shots, and
he's so good too. Like that was the other thing. Yeah. They could have made him like he's delusional. He's not that good. Yeah. But then they show when he can act.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, yeah, what could be?
And that he sort of stuttered in real life.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Bruce Lee because as an Asian, people are always asking yes. me. Because did you know this is another kerfuffle?
Yes, totally. I've watched many, including Joe Rogan's.
Oh, about Bruce Lee in this movie?
Yeah.
Oh, what is Joe Rogan saying?
Oh, he was disappointed that they portrayed him that way because he, you know, and he had a debate with, what's his name, that's often on his podcast. Because, you know, from his perspective, Bruce Lee wouldn't have been that, like, that arrogant in front of someone like that and blah, blah, blah. But there's definitely a debate. And Quentin has been interviewed about it, and he's like, no, I heard Bruce Lee say stuff like that. Like, not him, but, you know, like, Quentin was literally basically saying that, that's not an exaggeration. It's not an exaggeration for him to say that he could have kicked, what's his name's,
Muhammad Ali's,
but that the Linda Lee apparently wrote that in her biography or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. People like to rewrite history.
Yeah.
And it's like, today, Bruce Lee is like this god among Asians, and I'm Asian, god among martial artists. He's Asian, so he must have been a sweet guy. He must have been humble. He was always like the sidekick on Green Hornet, and he was, you know, this master and blah, blah. He was a human fucking being who was absolutely stuck on himself. Now, he should be stuck on himself. Muhammad Ali was stuck on himself.
Yeah, way more. Here's the difference. Let's say that this, you know, and Quentin even says, like, look, I took liberties, but let's say that this movie is mostly bullshit or whatever. But even what he said wasn't, oh, of course I could defeat him, right? It was like a calculated response. What would Muhammad Ali have said about anyone, right? Like, are you kidding me? I would wipe my ass with anyone in this world.
Yeah, Bruce Lee's calling card was, I can kick anyone's ass.
Right.
He wasn't like, I'm a humble actor who likes to have friends.
Right.
He was, I am a killer. And now it's debatable whether or not in casual conversation.
No, right. And like, that's to say, it's a movie. And
who knows? But I absolutely can see it. The little I know about Bruce Lee, and of course I never knew him, but I could absolutely see him doing that based on the things I did know about. Just find an actual interview from him at the prime, like in the early 70s, where he knows he's on camera and he knows people are watching, and just watch the way he talks. He's not a humble dude.
No.
You know, he's not like, well, you know, he's like Jackie Chan.
He's humble.
Jackie Chan is humble.
Yeah.
You know, when Jackie Chan gets interviewed, he's just like, well, sometimes I follow my... And he's not just like, well, I'm the best. But, you know, Jackie Chan can be stuck on himself. If you ask him the right question, he can be like, well, I'm good.
Yeah,
I'm fucking damn good.
Right.
Okay, so the daughter spoke out and said, Shannon Lee is her name. And she's saying, you know, in response to... Because afterwards, there's been this lots of talk and Quentin Tarantino is being interviewed, blah, blah, blah. Shannon Lee says, you know, Quentin Tarantino couldn't shut up about it. That would be, you know, oh, he could, Tarantino should shut up about it. That would be really nice. Or he could apologize and he could just say, I don't really know what Bruce Lee was like. I just wrote it for my movie, but that shouldn't be taken as how he really was. I mean, I guess that is one thing you could say.
Yeah.
Now, in the original script, did you know that Brad Pitt's character actually beats him in the original script?
I didn't.
And Brad Pitt was so uncomfortable with that he made Tarantino change the script.
And I actually think that's for the better.
Because,
you know, from seeing the previews, I actually had seen a thumbnail of the controversy where Brad Pitt is twisting Bruce Lee's arm, and I assumed that that was what would happen. I actually loved how it resolved because they actually they made Bruce Lee still into a badass.
Yeah,
he's going up against probably the best of the best of the stunt doubles who right. are badasses.
Right,
and the and it first gets a massive kickoff, and then second, you know, gets thrown in, and that's now we're 1-on-1.
But right. And the only thing you can really say about Bruce Lee getting thrown was that his mistake was that he accepted the challenge, that he didn't realize that Brad Pitt was actually was an okay fighter.
Right.
And so he kicks him in the chest. Brad Pitt goes flying.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt says, try that again.
Yeah.
And Bruce Lee stupidly says, okay, I'll do the exact same thing.
Exactly.
If Bruce Lee would have been like, nah, I'm not going to do the exact same thing. He could have won.
So he's still a badass.
He did the exact same thing. Brad Pitt was ready for it, threw him, and then...
And then they start fighting, and they're going at it.
And then it's cut off. We never know who's going to win.
Right. And to be fair, there might have not been a winner because they weren't trying to kill each other.
Yeah.
Not only that, Quentin was asked about this, and one of the things he said, like, look, in real life, Brad Pitt could not beat Bruce Lee, okay? But my character that I invented can.
Right.
If I say he can beat him, he can beat him because I invented him. It's like asking, can Dracula beat Bruce Lee in a match? Which is a great point, right? Like, it's a fiction.
And there's a lot of one, hero worship, but particularly in martial arts. There's this thing in martial arts, and because I had a friend who studied underneath a student of Bruce Lee, and Bruce Lee invented his own style of martial arts. I can't remember what it's called.
Jeet Kune Do.
Okay, and so he studied that the way he talked about his teacher, let alone Bruce Lee, was always like in this very unrealistic, grandiose manner. Also, in martial arts in Asia as well. There's this delusional worship, cult-like worship of the leader of these of these packs. So much so that all you got to do is YouTube, Google some of these videos of these masters, quote unquote, who can they don't even have to touch their opponents.
Dimmak is actually not even Dimmak. Because Dimmak is death touch. These are, you don't even touch them.
Right. That just look it up on YouTube if you haven't seen it. The old master will be so revered that, and he'll be demonstrating his mastery, and his students will be coming at him, and he won't even touch him, and he just sort of waves his hand, and the student goes flying.
Yeah.
Now, it's possible that it's psychogenic, that the students actually feel a force pushing them away that's subconscious because they're so respectful. It's also possible they're just completely faking it because, you know, it's a mass illusion.
And a mix. Because, like you know, did you ever attend the hyper-Christian revivals in the huge churches and things like that?
Right.
Like, and I witnessed people speaking in tongues and being healed and all these things. And I knew many of them. And I knew that they weren't paid to fake it.
Right. It's sort of like hypnotism. There's a pathway to our brains that can make that happen. So there's this in martial arts culture. There's this thing that you have to worship. It's sort of like hip hop culture, where if you're in hip hop, generally speaking, you have to brag about how good you are at hip hop. Or if you're in indie rock, you have to, you know, adamantly avoid bragging about the fact that you're good at indie rock. There's cultural notions, and there's a cultural notion in martial arts that if you're of a certain level, you are invincible. And you're not just invincible, but your character is invincible.
Right.
You cannot be criticized.
Right.
Everything you do is the best. You're at one with nature. You're at one with your soul. You're perfectly enlightened. Everything you say is brilliant. You can never be beat. And of course, that's ridiculous. These are human beings.
If you don't believe that as a student, you don't have a path forward that's as exciting.
Right. Well, and you might be kicked out.
Right.
So, and yeah, it's so much more exciting to think that's a God that's going to teach me. And so, there is that culture, and there's absolutely that culture with Bruce Lee, And it would probably existed back then as well. So if you're Bruce Lee and you're like the most well-known martial artist in the entire world, do you think he's going to have a lot of yes men around him? Yeah. Do you think he's going to have a huge ego? Yeah. Do you think that like Michael Jordan had a big ego at his top? Do you think Tiger Woods thinks he's good at golf?
Yeah.
Do you think Bruce Lee thought he was a badass fighter? Yes. So yeah. For him to say, and he liked to entertain people. And the other thing as an Asian American that I will talk about is that I grew up in the 70s and 80s when people assumed I knew martial arts. And I would get this vibe from people sometimes who didn't know me. And they'd be like, oh, show me a move. Show me a move. There was this fascination with white people with Asian Orientalism of martial arts. They thought – because they would see the kung fu movies and they thought – you know, I had people – who wouldn't fight me because I was Asian. They were like, well, that guy's Asian. He's going to kill you. And I was large for my age anyway, right. But so I probably
compounded the problem.
I probably would have killed him. But they would avoid fighting me because I was Asian. There was this thing back then that isn't present now because you have more experience with Asians. But there was a thing back then. It was just like, that dude knows – not only does he know martial arts, but he is really good at it. He's going to do a triple flip and like pop your eye out.
And that's what we saw in all movies. As soon as an Asian person walked on, they were either a joke or they were a martial artist.
Right.
That was it.
So I had that experience too of like – so Bruce Lee, if we saw his – if this movie was focused on Bruce Lee, which would be kind of cool. I wonder if Quentin Tarantino will do that next. He's in his trailer and he's just trying to live his life and he's just a regular person. He's just, you know, trying to have his life. And he walks out into public and then all the white people, you notice we come on the scene, there's all these white people standing around Bruce Lee and they are expecting Bruce Lee to be the version of Bruce Lee they want him to
Absolutely.
Be. And so Bruce Lee, the person, steps in and I was okay, well, if people want me to, I guess I need to be the, you know, the Uncle Tom here and like
and we can't forget like so the guy was a physical specimen outside of the norm by far.
Yeah.
He was incredibly fast. He was such a coordinated individual.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he could impress the hell out of anyone casually.
Right.
Now, does that mean he could have beat everyone in a UFC tournament? Like, that's very different.
Yeah.
The other thing is he didn't just have that scene. He had the other scenes where he showed Bruce Lee training the stars, training what's-her-name and training her friend. And those scenes were not presented as a joke.
Right.
In fact, she was remembering that she was training with him and then she used it in the movie and everyone loved that scene in the movie. It was presented, honorable way.
Right.
The one criticism that I do see or that I felt a little bit from the daughter was – It may undermine how hard Bruce Lee had to work in that industry to be respected at all.
Yeah.
And so I could understand that perspective.
The last thing I'll say is that, okay, let's say that he is portrayed badly. You know, it's unfair. It was a little too arrogant, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people in history are portrayed badly. Paul McCartney in Backbeat is portrayed as this whiny little bitch. And John Lennon is this cool, suave, reasonable guy. And Paul McCartney's like, meh, 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 I'm jealous. Meh, meh, meh. And when I watched Backbeat, I was just like, holy crap. The person who wrote this script was definitely not on Paul's side.
No, he's a Johnophile.
Yeah. In fact, I think What's-Her-Face, the woman in the movie who – she was like one of the script like inspiration. Anyway. So certainly people in history are – you know, Nixon in certain movies is probably depicted unfairly at times. You know, JFK is probably depicted. But the difference here is that Asians are almost never represented. And so when you finally get a character in an all –
it was a historical
– all character. White fucking film, once again, another, you know, movie about white people. And as an Asian American, I'm like, oh, another Asian American. How great. And they're not like at least likable. Then it hurts.
Right.
So if there were 25 other depictions of – Bruce Lee from various different angles and then they had this one.
Yeah.
Then Shannon Lee would be like, well, whatever.
Right.
But when you finally get a rep, you finally get a depiction and it looks not ideal,
right,
then it hurts even more.
Of course, of course. It's, you know, the other thing I thought about was, look, as a character development thing, he's trying to establish for the audience that Brad Pitt's character isn't just a good stuntman. He is the ultimate badass. Just period. He's the ultimate manly man's
badass. I feel like Tarantino's script didn't really get that across as well as... I mean, he did a little bit of that, but I don't...
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, but...
What?
Well, not in terms of his physical prowess, let's just put it that way.
I thought he did a great job. Like, because that would undermine the point I was making, so let me finish my point, and then you can still undermine it, but... Because I felt like, look, when... Who's he going to put up against? Well, he put him up against the hippie. Oh, big deal. He punched a hippie. What? Well, you put him up against the greatest known fighter in history, apparently, right? That's different to show, like, this guy's so good he could go up against Bruce Lee.
What they should have done is they should have shown Bruce Lee kicking some other badass's ass just before...
That's only necessary if everyone in the world doesn't know who the hell Bruce Lee is.
But then you... Because... Well, but a lot of people, even if you do know Bruce Lee, you might think, well, he was a movie star, but was he actually good?
I could go along with that rationale. That said, it puts him in a bind because he can't make – if he made Bruce Lee really just like this wise, calm, humble guy.
Not humble. I'm just saying like
– Oh, I'm not disagreeing with your previous point. I'm now saying that he had to give a reason why we would feel actually root for Brad Pitt in the scene.
He's being arrogant. Yeah.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say is that Quentin Tarantino movies are almost always criticized for being misogynistic. Berto, what do you think?
Yeah. He's a guy, came from a different era, and yeah, I think his natural inclination, even though he's had a lot of great, strong female stars in his movies, I think his natural inclination is to make a boys movie. But
that's different than being misogynistic, like actually.
Sure. Well, okay.
Because like in Hateful Eight, the...
I see what you're saying.
What's-her-face is just routinely...
Okay, fine. You know, my bad. Yeah, I guess if we're stretching the definition, then yes, but otherwise no. No, then I disagree. I think it's a sex... I think his movies are somewhat sexist and very male-oriented, at least most of them and stuff. But I would disagree with the misogynistic part. Yeah.
They also say that he's obsessed with feet. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, did you notice all the feet?
Yes, lots of feet. In fact, that made me very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like the dirty feet everywhere. Yeah. Oh, I hate dirty feet. By the way, what do you mean? Brad Pitt goes parkour style up to the roof.
Yeah, yeah.
Brad Pitt punches out the hippie in one punch.
Yeah, yeah.
And gets him to change the freaking tire. Yeah. And then, like, that end scene, like...
Yeah, I get it.
Okay.
And the last thing I'll say about misogyny and Quentin Tarantino is, yeah, I get it. And he's been making movies for 30 years now, so we have to consider the time and era that he was creating back in the day. One could argue that there are feminist elements to his movie. I mean, Kill Bill has a central female character who kills everyone.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that his movies are made for a particular sort of audience. It's sort of the thing that I always think about is like, if let's say the most famous musician in the world happened to be like world jazz.
Yeah.
And every critic and every human is, well, this, you know, this famous artist, you know, Mbutu, you know, Smith is like the best. So you got to go see his music. But you're not into world jazz.
Right.
And you walk out and you go like, it was too world jazzy for me.
Yeah. there was not enough distortion guitar.
Yeah, there wasn't enough triangle, you know.
Yeah.
Like, there wasn't enough opera. And then you think, and then the person concludes, therefore...
They hate
that. Mbutu Smith is a terrible musician.
Well, or actually, they hate that other kind of music, right? Or they hate people that would like that other kind of
music. Right.
Yeah.
They hate... how could you like Mbutu Smith?
Yeah.
What kind of weirdo are you to like that? What's wrong with you that you like that? Everyone say like, well, music is personal. It's a taste. Movies are the same.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino is a genre.
Yeah.
He's, to some extent, extended on a genre that has existed as an alternative genre to film for many years. But he's, you know, he sort of created his own genre.
He definitely created his own brand, that's for sure.
And if you go to a, you know, Quentin Tarantino movie and expect something different and be upset and think it's shit and you've never, you know, because like people who review this movie, they're like, yeah, everyone likes it. Stupid. I've never liked it. And, you know, because I've never liked any of Tarantino movies. And I'm like, well,
okay.
Then I'm not fine.
Great.
But it's just not your taste.
Yeah. It's like
there's so many like horror movies, for example.
Yeah. It's like, okay.
I don't like horror movies. So when I go to a horror movie, you know, but I don't go like everyone who likes horror movies is an idiot.
You're like, Berto, what did you think of the new double chocolate fudge flavor from Baskin Robbins? Like, ooh, don't like it at all. You're like, oh, really? Yeah, no, terrible. And then days later, you offer me some vanilla ice cream. I'm like, oh, I hate all kinds of ice cream. I never eat ice cream. It's the worst thing in the world. Now you're like, wait. So then that review you wrote is irrelevant.
Right.
Who cares if you thought the double chocolate was terrible? You hate ice cream.
Right.
And that's kind of like, well, if you're going to review a Quentin Tarantino movie and you hate his whole genre, his whole style, then, well, fine. But
yeah,
it's useless.
Having said that, it's not as if Tarantino is a strong feminist director, writer, creator. He is definitely staying within some neutral masculinity and some toxic masculinity and elevating and you know, glorifying some toxic masculinity elements for sure.
Yeah.
And in 50 years, we're going to look back at it and there's going to be some snickering, the same way that when we look at movies from 50 years, like when I see Harvey, for example, which is a beloved movie with, Stewart, what's his name? Jimmy
Harvey.
Stewart. Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if
everybody's
seen
that. Oh, it's a classic. No, one of those classics you haven't seen. Hmm. He has an invisible rabbit called Harvey that he sees. Anyway, it's sort of like the Forrest Gump of the 50s or something. And when I watch that movie, it is like so sexist. But at the time, and even into the 70s, you wouldn't see that element of the movie. So are we going to see that in Quentin Tarantino movies in the future in a way that perhaps people like me can't see it and other people can? Yeah, undoubtedly. But when I'm watching it, I'm not. It's not misogynistic in the way that other movies are that would actually turn me off to it.
I recently started listening to 1001 Nights on audio, one narration of it. And, you know, the opening story, this vizier is traveling and he comes and he finds his wife in bed with a black cook. And he is so distraught that he chops them both up with his sword. Like, that's part of the opening story. And that one's not like a lesson story. That's like, of course he did, because, you know, she was sleeping around with him, especially with a black cook. And of course he killed them both with it. Like, these are stories from, you know, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, whatever. And so it's like, times change. People evolve. I think right now, Quentin will probably be a genre that was frozen in time a little bit. And to your point, maybe 50 years from now, we'll laugh a little bit.
Well, this episode, I thought we were going to talk about like 10 different things, but we only got to talk about one thing.
It was a fun thing. I love that thing.
Well, that does it for that one thing of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.